I'd like to introduce Jeff Waugh, who's going to be talking about doing the sequel to Gnome 1. Yes?
Yes. Good morning. Apologies for being late. We just had to get my talk working on another laptop. My PPC doesn't have a VGA connector. Useful machines that they are. So I'm here to talk to you about GNOME. This is a reference to one of the first conversations about GNOME 2. Since then, 2.0 has had this magical whisper. So that's actually Federico in his weblog. The date, however, is surprising. It was a long time ago. So we had to get GNOME 2 right. There was a lot riding on this release. So all of the ingredients for a successful software project were there. We had no visible leadership. Most of the people who were working on the project as project maintainers had sort of disappeared. Miguel went over to work on Mono. He's sort of bouncing off his energy over to something completely different after Bonobo and GNOME. Nat was working for Zimian. A lot of people were working for Zimian and being shifted off onto non-community projects. Cool stuff like Evolution, but it meant the actual desktop wasn't getting not many people were looking at it. We had a moving target. No one actually knew what GNOME 2 was going to be. It was just this incredible GNOME 2. What is that? So we took a hell of a long time to define what the release was going to be. Originally, we were going to release just a port of GNOME 1.4 to GTK 2, which, if you've used GNOME 2, you can see that it's not even remotely close to that. Then we decided, halfway through the GNOME 2 process, that we would just release a developer platform with all of the new GNOME libraries. That kind of failed because you can't release libraries without anyone having used them because they're bound to suck. And when we decided that that was a bad idea and went through and finally did our desktop, we realized that that would have totally sucked because our libraries were just a joke. Fat wads of cash. There's nothing better than just having this huge influx of cash to make everyone, you know, feeling jealous and, you know, well, I'm not getting paid for this. We had a lot of corporate interest, and it feels a bit weird when you've got a whole new group of people getting involved who are not part of the community. We also tripled the size of our team. Sun came in. There were New Zealand people working on it. Sun hired Wipro, an Indian outsourced programming company, to work on GNOME. So the Brooks notion of don't add more people to your project, look at that, let's throw heaps and heaps more people on. That worked really well for us. The scary thing is that, naturally you have to teach people what they're doing within the project when they join. We actually had to teach people to code, which was a real pain. Bring in some mercenaries. We had the Wipro guys. The weird thing with that is that they didn't really care as much as we always have. You know, when you're working on a community project, everyone's doing it because they love it. Now we had people who were doing it just because they were paid to do it, and they didn't really have their business riding on it. The Sun hackers were all kind of, yeah, rock on, let's replace CDE because that's fun. The Wipro guys didn't really have any of that, so that was different. The other thing, you'd think that we'd go and find a leader, you know, to make all of this stuff work, to pull all this crap together. Instead of doing that, we found a scapegoat, sucker number one, which is me. I joined the release team in a fit of, oh my god, I can't code, I need to help out somehow, and said, oh yeah, I'll do like web stuff so that everyone knows what's going on in the release process, which I did none of. And then about a month after that, Maciej Stachowiak left GNOME for Apple and said, oh gee, I don't have enough time to work on GNOME anymore, so why don't you do the release management? Okay, that can't be so hard. I mean, at that stage, I'd done project management for about five people, and you know, 500 doesn't seem all that. Just a couple of zeros. Yeah, and as it turns out, he went on to work on the Safari project, which involves KDE technology. So everyone was kind of, oh, right, okay, fine. Corporate involvement. We have lots of companies contributing to GNOME now. Originally, it was sort of Red Hat, Zimian, Easel back in the 1.4 days. Now we've got heaps. They made massive contributions. A lot of people think corporates are taking over and all that kind of stuff. Basically, they're now part of the team. And it actually works like that now. Accessibility was a big Sun thing. Most of the work that's being done on that is purely Sun-driven. Implementing accessibility stuff is boring, and you know, we don't see a lot of value for it right now because we don't have all of the tools to use it. But Sun are right behind it because in the US there's Section 508, which is their law requiring full accessibility support in software for government. Which means that now GNOME can be used by the US government, and the EU has passed some laws about that recently, the UK, Australia has similar laws that everyone just ignores. Interesting thing about Section 508 was that it was all of the recommendations were made by Microsoft. So what they basically did is they were allowed to author government policy to lock everyone else out. So let's write this whole spec that no one else can implement, and no one else will be able to get into government. We've done it, so we can do that. Usability, we have a bunch of people who are like HCI students at university working on the usability team, and then Sun sent their gung-ho troops back in who are HCI experts who worked on CDE and Java. And it was a bit of a mix-up, but they've got some really, really cool guys working on the usability stuff. The other thing that really helped us out was stability. Sun have to support their software for 10 years after they ship it. For us, we don't even remember it like 10 check-ins after it's released, you know. So that's a huge difference in the level of QA that we have to care about. And so their 2.0 release, which they haven't made yet, they're really, really late, is really, really incredibly solid. More full-time hackers is great. It's really cool to have lots of people working on the project. The only problem is that if you can only spend a few hours on the project at night, you get home and you have this massive inbox full of all of the conversations that have been going on all day, and you don't actually get anything done. Because the full-time hackers talk on email and IRC and all that kind of stuff, and you just have to keep on trying to keep up with all the work that they're doing, especially when they're changing APIs and stuff like that. That gets fun. GNOME has always been worldwide. There was a funny article in the SMH and The Age the other week from Sean Gordon, who's the CEO of the company, saying that GNOME is a United States thing and KDE is European. And just kind of funny for a guy from the States to say, because you know, it's like we're all European and we're enlightened and they're all United States and they're fascists or whatever like that. But it's really not true. We've always had people from around the world, Europe, US. We've got contributors from Brazil, Mexico, Chile, everywhere. The weird thing is that it just feels bigger now because everyone's communicating, because the team is working much better, it feels big. For a while there, GNOME was kind of Boston-based and North Carolina-based, Simeon and Red Hat being Boston, North Carolina. Now, everyone's in on it and contributing a huge amount. And amazingly enough, all of this, between the community and all of the companies, are actually functioning as a team. Dive in with questions, by the way, if you need to. Just say dude, something or other. Yeah, this is weird. I embarrassed Glyn at our at Guadec by putting his face off, which beautiful shot. They have their own people inside doing their own releases, but Sun has to play kind of the community game. They don't want to look as if they're taking over. And if they said, hey, we're going to hire this release manager dude, and he's going to have, you know, Sun Microsystems, blah, 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 at sun.com, everyone would be like, we're being taken over.
So what you're saying is you think there would actually be a negative reaction
community? There'd be a perception, especially outside. I mean, a lot of this stuff, these communication sort of issues, we understand within GNOME, but, you know, you have like /.dot and GNOME-desktop.org and all this kind of stuff, and there's this one dude, OGalaxyO. I told myself I shouldn't mention this guy. Damn. He's like the mega troll. He posts these massive long rants on /.dot and GNOME-desktop.org, and he manages to get into every conversation. I don't know what he does with this time. But that kind of, that it would be a bad perception kind of thing. And they want to play it safe, really. The community is hugely important to them, but it's a balancing act. So this is Glyn Foster at sun.com. And it's really difficult for a big company like Sun to get involved in free software because they don't understand the process, they don't understand the people, they have no, you know, sort of knowledge, unless they've been involved from the beginning or they sit around watching for, you know, years, which Sun actually did. They had some people in our 1.4 release team, those sorts of things. This guy is one of the Irish Sun desktop dudes. And he basically saved Sun's ass, and Sun doesn't really know it. Huge faceless corporation trying to get involved in a free software project where everyone's sort of lovey-dovey and knows each other. Glyn was the first person within Sun to really get involved in the community and to bring out the other Sun contributors to work within the community. If you're in a big company and you want to get involved in a free software project, you need like one person like Glyn to make it real for everyone else. He's the only person that made all of the, you know, thousands of programmers within Sun actually real to us. So that's been a huge benefit. This is Martin Poole, who's actually next door doing a talk on DISCC. He made this comment on Advocado a while ago talking about usability, because there was a big argument about how GNOME is unusable now when we've spent so much time working on usability. And this is kind of the crux of where we're coming from with our usability project. These are the kinds of responses we've got about GNOME 2. Where are all my preferences? Who's gone from 1.4 to 2 and missed their preferences? Okay, cool. I'm uninstalling GNOME from my system and using KDE. That's always a good one. Everyone feels really rock on. Let's fix this up for you. GNOME is completely unusable to me now because, and it will always be something stupid like, my panel doesn't show tiles when I roll over my buttons anymore. Completely unusable. Havok is the Antichrist. He's named well to be the Antichrist, but Havok is kind of seen as being the evil demon behind all of this usability corruption that's going on in GNOME. And of course, how do you change window managers from Metacity to Sawfish? Metacity is our new window manager by Havok, the demon behind usability in GNOME, which is no crap. There's no more crap. Sawfish had thousands and thousands and thousands of preferences, and Metacity is basically do it right. the question was, why are we using Sawfish and not something like Enlightenment or one of the many other window managers out there? The major reason is we ship Sawfish with GNOME 2.0. We're shipping Metacity with 2.2. Big reason is it's impossible to support. There are so many little tweaks in Sawfish that you can have your window manager completely change behavior and not quite know which of the many interacting changes that you've made in your preferences. Metacity has about, I think it's about 12, 13 preferences now in total, which compared to Sawfish is, wow, amazing. Things like Enlightenment don't support the enhanced window manager specs, so we can't really use them well with two. Oh, right. Yeah. The question was, how do I not run Nautilus? This is amazing amount of energy put into, why do I have icons on my desktop? And why wouldn't you have icons on your desktop? I don't know. I actually have the thread that decided why Nautilus takes over your root window. A lot of people like running their X screensavers on their root windows or X penguins or those sorts of things. I have the original thread, and it has all sorts of things to do with X sync and having multiple windows on the root menu and stuff like that. We're actually going to do a news story about that in the next few weeks. You can stop Nautilus by removing it from your session, or you can just disable the desktop. What does it break? Oh yeah, our control center is now Nautilus based, which everyone really hated. Yeah. All right, I'll help you with that later. Bring your notebook, I'll fix it. Yeah, and it's comments like these that make everyone think that Havok is the evil man. We understand what window managers are, but we shouldn't have to, yeah. And the big argument between people who want their preferences and people who don't want their preferences is lowest common denominator versus greatest common factor. You'll often find people saying, you're targeting, you know, like my grandmother, or those sorts of things, and this is not a usable system for a technologist, and those sorts of things, and it's the lowest common denominator thing. There wouldn't really be any use in targeting the lowest common denominator at all in a desktop system, because then it wouldn't do anything. What we strive for is to do the greatest common factor. The GNOME desktop release now has the basic set of stuff that should really be useful for everyone. So instead of having 11 clocks for your applet, we have one. That's not a huge leap in kind of, you know, being sensible. And a lot of people say all of this sort of stuff should be shipped with GNOME, and we should have all of these sorts of preferences, but they're not applicable to everyone. So that's the big difference between what we used to strive for. Is like, you know, someone sends you a patch and says, I need this option. It's like, well, all right, you know, you need this option. That means like 50 other people will need this option. We'll put it in. So, you know, it was like kind of being a yes man kind of patch management. Now it's, who is going to care about this option? Is it actually a preference? Here's the GNOME 1.4 panel control applet for setting the panel settings. Here's GNOME 2. I mean, if you look back at all of these, there's like, you know, what sort of tile images should appear underneath your icons when you roll over them? What should they be when you click on them? These are kinds of things that should just work. They're not really preferential or anything like that. Some. There, I mean, The big thing about all the removing preferences is, you know, end user usability, but there's a huge cost in terms of code, handling all that kind of stuff. And it's really nice purging all of that and getting rid of it, because it means that we have less to support, less bugs. I mean, the kinds of interdependent preferences in Swordfish make it the code insane. So some of those things you can change in gconf editor, but a lot of it has actually been removed. Yeah, this is one of my favorite quotes from the author of LWM, which is a very, very, very minimal window manager. It does nothing. And his response to one of his users was this: you can use GCC to fix it. And that happens a lot. We have these huge discussions on Bugzilla now about what should be the right behavior. Instead of saying, we'll add options to change the different behaviors for what people prefer, we'll just try and pick the right one. And during the 2.0 development process, we had our window list applet, which is the thing that looks like the Windows 98 start bar kind of thing, where you can switch between your apps. And we removed a lot of the things like, you know, what's the maximum size that this can be in your panel? How wide can each of the buttons be? The maximum size, the minimum size, whether to show icons or not, you know, all these kinds of preferences. And the goal was to just make it work. Instead of trying to set all of these preferences up to make it work properly on your particular desktop, it should flat out just work without any configuration whatsoever. And so Havoc got flamed so viciously by people within the developer community and outside for this being an utter mess. Put my preferences back, because this doesn't work, it's crap. Suddenly when he did that last check-in and it worked properly, there were no more Bugzilla reports. Everyone was just like, oh, click, 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 and it's fine. Here are some screenshots of GNOME 2.2. For those people who think fonts, anti-aliased fonts are blurry, these are actually scaled down from 1024 by 768, so they're unhinted fonts, but you know, they look a bit arse because of that. This is our new font preferences control applet. You can change your fonts and turn on anti-aliasing, all those sorts of things. We now have recent files, global, and a whole infrastructure for handling that. The window on the right is the setting for multimedia keys, so that you have, you know, your internet keyboard kind of thing with mail buttons and call my mom buttons and those sorts of things. That works. We have new meta themes, so instead of changing, you know, 50,000 different themes in all of your applications, you can just click once and it will choose a theme that handles, currently it does your GTK theme, your window manager theme, icons theme, which is a whole new standard from freedesktop.org, and that works really nicely. It's got nice little thumbnailing so you can see exactly what it's going to look like. Ugly themes! No. lots of people... Oh, thanks very much. Lots of people have queried why we have such ugly themes in the default distribution of GNOME Desktop. They're not actually ugly, really. They're accessibility themes. So the idea behind this one is for people who need high contrast themes so that they can see what's going on across their screen. They have an icon theme that has the pretty icons for trash and the home and those sorts of things. The entire set of icons throughout the entire interface changes. Yeah.
Literally, and she just had this. She had this app that she ran in the background. It allowed her to scan. Opening up her mouse was sort of this inverted. You did point with the mouse. You pointed with the display where you wanted on your virtual, your enormous virtual window. And you know, she had to have bright, you know, like canary yellow and red and black.
Yeah.
Three colors so she could see the distinction.
That was. We had an earlier theme that looked like that, but yeah. There's actually another theme called the BSOD theme, blue screen of death, and what it does is it changes every single thing on your screen to that pretty blue that Windows NT shows when it dies. And the idea behind it is so that people who are not blind can experience using a computer that they can't see, and also picking up bugs in things like icons and stuff like that. If you can see an icon, it's a bug. which is kind of the wrong way around for most usability, but...
Have you seen really dodgy behavior of theming in GNOME, where you could change things with inherent themes from the last four themes that you've been trying as you move through themes?
Yeah. We've fixed that.
I mean?
No.
If you have tabs that are square, and you move to a theme that's got round things, if it... and move to another thing?
That show me.
Explicitly set square tabs back?
Well, I haven't seen that behavior, so show me. Okay. Show me later on. We also have a low contrast theme, which I really didn't understand when I first saw this. I thought, why on... Yeah, there is. There's a X settings standard that we're trying to get everyone to use, and you can set an X settings for what the theme is. And Qt is now supporting it. Mozilla isn't yet. That's going to be interesting because you actually have to restart Mozilla to change themes. You'd think JavaScript could do that. But yeah, so we're trying to get support for all those sorts of things based on X settings. Yeah, low contrast. I didn't get it. It looks really ugly. Why would anyone need this? But some vision disabilities require, like if you have white on the screen, they can't see anything because it really, really hurts. So low contrast is for people who suffer from that. And you can see the start here icon is a bug in this early screenshot. But yeah, everything, it just looks... diminished. All of the icons throughout Nautilus, all of the menu icons, all those sorts of things, all themed. Here's some new bits and pieces from Nautilus. We have a new music view, which is actually useful. If you actually find the music view useful at all. It's good while we're waiting for Rhythmbox to work out what the user interface is going to be and those sorts of things. Thank you. Cleaned up user interface stuff. Gedit has most recently used files dropped down from the open button, which I've seen stuff like using templates with a drop down open button, but I haven't seen recently used files, so I reckon that's pretty cool. File roller, searching for files is a lot nicer now. So release engineering. Finally, what we've got after GNOME 2.2 is everyone's agreed to do time-based releases every 6 months, which was a huge effort because there's like one faction saying, no, we should have all of our features. When we want to add a feature, we should be able to, and then we can say we're finished and we're done. If we did that, we'd have releases like Debian. And the thing is that we used to have releases like Debian. Like GNOME 1.4.1 hasn't come out yet. It's still at release candidate 2 or 1. And that's just because no one actually, the time-based releases thing is really important because you can just do, you have features at a point, then you cut off and you say, right, it's QA from here on in, and then you release. I have no idea how Debian's going to achieve that because it's a much bigger problem, but yeah. We have GNOME 2.2 due at the end of the month. We have release candidate 2 coming out tonight or whenever I'm not drunk. Doing conference calls and releases when drunk is a bad idea. We've actually succeeded with our first 6 month cycle. And it's been a really hard one too because we did lots of point releases for 2.0 because it was kind of buggy when it first came out. We've done well. We have a really solid 8-member release team. We meet every week to do a conference call, which is fun because they're like 4 a.m. for me. It's easy to get drunk before 4 a.m. All of our sub projects are rocking on really well. I haven't mentioned the web project because it's an utter failure. if you look at our website, it's still ugly. Internationalization, we just had a report the other day that we now have 27 supported languages. Supported basically means 85% or over translated messages, which is really cool. Was it Mongolian that came in? I'm pretty sure it was Mongolian that came in from having no translations to like 96% in 1 week. Hordes of Mongols just... the usability team, we released our human interface guidelines around the time of 2.0. We've implemented a lot of that sort of stuff in 2.2. And now we're getting an updated document, so for 2.4 we can redo everything again. They're actually pretty pretty sane releases of the HIG, only getting updates to things that are easily implementable. User documentation, we have a new project lead for the docs team, John Fleck, and we've been getting heaps and heaps of stuff from Sun and strangely IBM. They're contributing a lot to our documentation, so. Accessibility team, we have one guy in Sun who goes absolutely nuts about accessibility, and if you manage to get him into a conversation about accessibility, you'll be there for hours. One of the first release team meetings where I was coordinator, we invited him along to talk about accessibility and how we could help get all of this stuff into GNOME 2, and he spoke for 45 minutes straight and no one could get a word in. So he's really passionate about accessibility. And they have a team of about 10 people working on that. We have a new bugs team forming. We had an incredible experience with bugs during 2.0 and 2.0, well, not so much 2.2, but Louis Villa from Zimian has been our QA and bugs meister, and he's kicked so much ass. But now he's working a bit more on Zimian stuff, and so he's taken away, and everyone's trying to fill this void. He's the kind of person that put all of his colored pencils in the right way when he was a kid, and you know he's really good at bug stuff. But the most important thing about GNOME is the love is back. We're all working together and kicking butt. Questions about GNOME generally, not just stuff in my talk.
Can go back to the point you raised about there's no point in delivering a window manager to the lowest common denominator. A large percentage of the users that I deal with, people that work in a corporate environment, that have been told by their corporate governance teams, no, you can't change the look of your desktop, no, you can't change your background image, no, you can't change your interfaces, no, you can't this sort of stuff. That is standard. For those sort of people, when I'm introducing them to the concept of Linux, I usually give them something like SWM, because that's the window manager where they have to go and make changes to a file, which I make read only to change their window manager. Is there any plans to introduce that sort of stamp-down, lockdown desktop?
Yeah.
Can already do it?
Yeah. One of the new technologies in GNOME 2, it shipped with GNOME 1.4 but wasn't really used throughout, is gconf, which is the registry. Everyone calls it the registry because it kind of looks like one, but the cool thing is that, that there are pluggable backends. And it does notifications. This is really cool. When you're, I can probably do a demo of this. I have control of James's laptop. Which one's your system one? Okay. All right, yeah, so this is gconf editor. Looks just like the registry, only it tastes so much better. Sorry? Yes, that message has been removed now because it scared a lot of people. A lot of our preferences we've moved out of the user interface. You can still get to them here. The great thing about this, unfortunately, I don't know why this key's not documented, but anyway, there's actually documentation on every key. For those of you who have to deal with Windows systems, you go through the registry and it's just utter crap throughout the entire thing. There are documentations, translatable documentations for every key in gconf. So this, what this is demonstrating is gconf notification. Your applications listen on a particular key, and the gconf user daemon notifies them when stuff changes. So I can go up to... I should be careful. All right. This is running, what, this is CVS at the moment, isn't it? Oh, okay. Let's see, what's a good one? Badly.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
We're attempting to replace, because currently it uses Corba to talk between the various daemons and stuff like that, so that's definitely on the cards for being replaced. Okay, so I'm changing the mouse button modifier, which you can see down in the bottom window, to Alt. Okay, that was a bad one. All lowercase? There's a documented key. Okay, so that was CVS from a few weeks ago. We fixed lots of bugs since then. Damn. Demoware. Yeah. That's more a deficiency of the gconf editor interface for the time being, but it is, because it's based on strings, it is hard to describe what's what.
The only thing about the group of people, you know, want to add people, you want to personalize them automatically.
You've already got their information. Can you do that with the script? Or yep, sure. You have gconf defaults, system defaults. You also have mandatory settings. Mandatory settings are stuff that you can't change. So you can set a user so that they can't change any setting. But if you set up the gconf defaults, then you can pretty much change their entire desktop so that when every user logs in, they have a custom desktop. Yeah. That's the plan. Evolution doesn't currently use gconf, so not yet. Rusty? That's the ideal. I mean, at the moment, it stores it in really ugly XML files in the user's home directory, which is why NFS is a pain in the ass. There is an LDAP backend that's working now and is implemented. That's going to be cool because the sysadmin can add all of these keys, change keys, do mandatory settings, all that sort of stuff within LDAP. The big problem with LDAP, though, is that you don't want your settings public because there's going to be stuff in there like, you know, passwords and things like that. It's generally regarded that you shouldn't put passwords in gconf, but they probably will be. But it's not the sort of stuff you want to make public. So you have to bind... you have to bind to the LDAP server from the user daemon, which is kind of hard because you don't want to be typing in all of your stuff. Kerberos would be fine, but yeah, every time you change a setting, you don't want to be typing in your password.
Yeah, you said about the HTML server, but you can label this versus Chrome versus what about, you know, you can have as many bits of error you want, and it scales
with
based on, you know, how
advanced
the user is. So
if it's
only
played,
then
they
might, you know,
right, yeah. Yeah, the question was, should we have user levels for the amount of preferences that we show? We tried this. If anyone remembers the original versions of Nautilus, we had a little, what was it called again? The ski ramp menu?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, the signs when you go skiing is like green and red and black, and so we had this undecipherable menu that had, you know, beginner, intermediate, advanced, and they were based on like ski signs. But the idea was that when you changed to advanced, you had extra stuff that you could use, and you were only able to see, you were able to see all of the preferences. When you're back to beginner, some features were disabled and a lot of preferences would disappear. The problem is with that is that it's impossible to support, because every time you have to deal with, you know, is blah 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 on? Oh, that's not there, I can't change that. Go into a different user level and change that, and go back to your old user level, you know. Yeah, it would reset. Yeah, so that was a real pain. What we got out of that was basically make the software just work. You know, you don't need all of that stuff to begin with. We can do that. Yeah, we have an SSH and SFTP based module in GNOME VFS, so you can type SFTP colon blah 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 and log in. Currently you need to use SSH keys, but you can do that. Same with Samba and those sorts of things.
I've seen Mano 2 on Mega 8 and Mano 8 9, and every time I use Nautilus and double click on an HTML document, click those, we're going to show the HTML. And when the HTMLs are made by things like Microsoft Word, it's like, we can't read that. Does the current Vault 2.2 just have that working already, so it actually renders it normally, and basically you have to come and work out how to install the plugin that you do, which I can never work out at
all. All right. The question was about HTML rendering in Nautilus and why doesn't it work so well. There's a Galleon plugin to do that, and that works really nicely because it uses Galleon and Mozilla. There's a GTK HTML one that doesn't work very nicely because GTK HTML is crap. It's unfortunate that the distributions are still shipping those, because they're not part of the GNOME desktop release, and most of the people working on Nautilus and GNOME think that viewing HTML in your file manager is a really dumb idea. So if you want to view HTML, use browser. They really rock. We're out of time?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.